Good morning, everyone. Okay, I'll be talking about self-insurance. There we go. Now, can I start off by asking who works in with superannuation? Nearly everyone. And who advises a self-insured fund? Okay, that's good. So this is relevant for many of us. What about a self-insured accumulation fund? Okay, that's good as well, because I guess this is particularly relevant for the self-insured accumulation funds, I think. Now, the Institute, as you're probably aware, is changing the way it provides its guidance. So guidance notes are going to become a thing of the past, and we're going to have professional standards and what we're calling practice guidelines. Now, the self-insurance note will be a practice guideline, so it's not going to be mandatory, but probably advisable to disclose where differences, material variations occur in your advice. Now, the practice guideline came about from 2005 when APRA raised concerns about self-insurance with super funds and basically said that public offer funds would not be allowed to offer self-insurance, that funds that weren't public offer had to only do it if it was well covered in their risk management statements and under actuarial control. And for accumulation funds with self-insurance, there should be segregated reserving. And APRA asked the Institute to prepare some guidance. Now, in 2007, this is another quote from APRA, it just tells us that nothing's changed. So what's been said in the past continues to apply. And a summary of APRA's views on the slide. Except those of you who are involved with self-insurance, it is likely that you've had to front APRA reviews over the last recent years. For most of our self-insured funds, APRA will ask the actuary to attend as part of the APRA reviews to speak on self-insurance. So this is very much a live issue with APRA, and something that we all need to be aware of. Okay, the progress with the practice guideline, it's almost ready. In 2005, a draft professional standard was distributed to members, so I hope you've all seen that and had a read. The practice guideline is very similar. We received only minor comments on the original professional standard that's simply been redrafted as a guidance note. So if you've been following the professional or draft professional standard that was distributed in 2005, then there won't be any surprises for you. And we hope it'll be released fairly soon. Okay, it affects anyone providing advice and self-insurance within the superannuation industry, not just APRA-regulated funds. And I note there's nothing in the guidance to suggest that when self-insurance isn't appropriate. And there's no explicit thing saying if you've got less than 1,000 members or less than 5,000 members, it's not appropriate. But we would say clearly it's not appropriate for small funds. This slide really just summarises what I'm going to cover, so I'll flip over that. Now, I guess this is all just common sense, but just some definitions. The insurable benefit's really just our standard future service component. So in an accumulation fund, we're talking about the amount above someone's account balance. In the defined benefit fund, normally the amount above someone's equitable share. Self-insurance is the part of that that is not externally insured. And be aware of unintended insurance. Now, this can occur occasionally. I might have seen it in corporate funds where you've got one TPD definition and then it's externally insured with a slightly different definition, and there can be gaps in the cover. Maybe an unsatisfactory financial position leads to unintended insurance. Where these things are immaterial, particularly if it's just an unsatisfactory financial position, then we wouldn't expect this guidance to apply. It's a funding issue rather than a self-insurance issue. Okay, so to undertake self-insurance analysis in accordance with the practice guideline, it's all about our standard actuarial techniques. We get the data, we get individual data for every member who is self-insured. we get enough data to be able to, calculate what their sum insureds is for death, TPD or any other types of insurance. We get your claims history so we can look at the experience since the last time a self-insurance valuation was done. If it's a defined benefit fund, then you're going to be doing this as part of your normal triennial investigation, I would think. Don't forget things like IBNRs, incurred but not reported reserves. It's very hard, we've found, to get data on IBNRs because we've found lots of administrators don't have records of date claim reported. They might have date of person became disabled, date of payment, but not the date of actually reporting. Similarly, of course, don't forget claims in being processed at current. With expenses, with a defined benefit fund, typically you're looking at the expenses in aggregate. It all forms part of the overall company contribution rate. You know, you don't need to look at it separately for self-insurance. But with accumulation funds where administration expense is being debited from a reserve, then clearly it needs to be looked at explicitly. Need to look at things like changes in practice in underwriting, looking at any change in claims assessment processes that may lead to the future being different to the past. And from all that, it's possible to make estimates about future experience, likely future experience. Now, we've looked at risks in four different areas. Pricing risk is the risk that the actuary gets it wrong, that our estimates of what the underlying rate of claims has been may be too high or too low. Experiences risk is about the volatility that you know, there's this random variation from year to year will occur. Catastrophe risk, the impact of a single event. Now, that can really be thought of as different components too, because you've got, you know, a particular event that may affect one site or one group of people, like a terrorism attack or a plane crash. But you've also got things like pandemics that will affect, you know, large different locations, not just a single location. And selection risk, if you have got any you know, automatic acceptance limits or other areas within the underwriting process or claims assessment that provide opportunities for selection. And risk tolerance is not a risk in itself, but it's about, well, what happens if there are more claims than we expect? What's the impact? Is it a defined benefit fund where the employer may get a small increase in their contribution rate? Is it an accumulation fund where ultimately the members are going to bear that risk and a large deduction from their accounts? And how? What's the tolerance? How much impact is it going to have on the employer or the member in the particular cases? This is just an example that I made up. It's obviously not in the guideline. Except just a simple analysis, like this table, can tell us a lot about the risks in a self-insurance situation. This is an accumulation case. I'll just give you a few seconds to look at some of the numbers there that I put in. At the bottom, I've got reserve, $7 million. Who would say, based on that data, is anyone prepared to put up their hand with only looking at it for a few seconds and say that reserve maybe isn't enough? Is anyone? Probably a bit hard without more time. Anyone thinks that the reserve's plenty? One or two brave people. I would say that with an average sum of short of $200,000, if the distribution of the sum insured was reasonably small, then a reserve of that side would often be enough, because with your year's premium coming in, you've got 3 years' worth of claims, and with 20,000 lives, you don't get that much variation. The issue here really is about the fact that there's a maximum sum insured for any member of $3 million, and that's the distribution of the claim size, and I suspect that I would prefer a higher reserve in this case because of that, because, well, if we look at the in more detail, if you've got 60 members with over $2 million sum insured and only reserve of $7 million, it's not just, you've got to take into account a small number of deaths within those people with high sum insureds could cause a significant impact. And this is very typical for corporate funds, that type of distribution. Within a unit-based insurance arrangements, you tend to get a much narrower distribution in sums insured, and hence you often don't need as big a reserve. Okay, pricing. In defined benefit funds, pricing kind of comes out in the wash in the employer contribution rate normally. So it's often not necessary to consider the pricing explicitly. Normally in a defined benefit fund, we're looking at the risks of self-insurance, as we've looked at earlier, but don't need to explicitly consider pricing. But for accumulation funds, then there is obvious a need to consider pricing explicitly and also to consider interaction with reserving. With reserving, again, for DB funds, not explicitly need to consider separate reserves, but obviously when you look at the risks for a DB fund, you'll have a look to see whether, you know, the size of the fund is big enough, the impact is big enough to make self-insurance appropriate for the particular fund. But with accumulation funds, APRA do require, and I think sensible practice requires, segregated reserves, reserves that are notionally increase with investment return in the same way as other notional reserves that claims are debited from, premiums are added to, and administration expenses are deducted and so forth. Be very careful about cross-subsidies. There should be no cross-subsidies between members with and without insurance. One of the pricing issues to consider is the cross-subsidies between generations of members. If you need to build your reserve, you're doing it at the expense of current members for the benefit of future members, so that may impact the timing at which reserves are built up or run down. Now, I guess I've spoken about insurance reserve. As far as dividing the reserve, then you might think of the reserve in different components. There's a premium reserve, which is all about how much reserve do you need just to be able to meet claims over or expected levels of claims in the coming periods. There's the pricing reserve, which is about in your premiums, do you want to explicitly run down the reserve or build up the reserve? And that may result in either additional premium or a deduction in premium depending on the size of the reserve. IBNR reserve, again, would normally be deducted before considering the adequacy, whether the reserve is adequate or not. So, as I said, you normally look at reserves net of the IBNR reserves. And with considering the size of the reserve, then we just run through each of those risks that we considered earlier, the experience risk, the pricing risk, the catastrophe risk, and so forth, to see whether self-insurance is appropriate. Often we do think of reserves as, you know, what is the multiple of a year's premium or the expected claims for a year, and often multiples of 1 to 2 times expected claims will be sufficient for a large fund if you don't get too wide a distribution of sums insured, but it really does depend on the individual circumstances of the fund, and that's why the practice guideline doesn't put in any guidance of that nature. You really need to look at it at a case-by-case basis. Again, this formula isn't in the practice guideline, but I just wanted to, you know, make you aware that there are lots of ways of looking at this quantitatively. If you assume that each claim is a binomial distribution with the probability of death or disablement being QI, and if you've got individual data, the sum insured is easy to calculate, the sum of a whole lot of independent binomial distributions is a normal distribution if you have enough lives. So you can use approaches like this. I know other actuaries have used stochastic analysis to look at self-insurance risks. The downside of these approaches is if you assume claims are independent, they're not going to deal well with catastrophe risk, and those type of things need to be considered separately. Okay. As far as the ongoing management of self-insurance, then it really depends on the circumstances. With defined benefit funds, it typically to be done as part of a triennial actuarial investigation. With accumulation funds, then again, you typically have 3 yearly reviews, but because the reserves are being calculated yearly, normally by the administrator or the fund, then it may be that some monitoring goes on every year, even though a detailed review will only take place every 3 years. And clearly advice needs to be given at the end of any review of the self-insurance arrangements around pricing, reserve levels and so forth. Okay. Now I'll hand straight over to John. Is that right, Paul?
I'll introduce John.
Okay. Yep.
Thanks very much, Matthew. Perhaps I could introduce John Ward now. John is a principal of Mercer. He's been working in the superannuation industry since 1973, joining Mercer in 1984, so has a number of years of experience. That experience includes consulting on actuarial and technical aspects of superannuation in public and private sector clients. He heads up Mercer's research and information team and is responsible for keeping Mercer's business up to date with legislation changes affecting superannuation. John's also a member of the Legislative Subcommittee of the Superannuation Employee Benefits Practice Committee, and his topic for today is first home saver accounts.
Thanks, Paul. It's actually first home saver accounts version 3. We had the initial Labor policy prior to the election. We had the discussion paper in February, which changed a lot of the rules. And then we had further announcements on budget night, which changed everything again. Government finally realised that they weren't going to get these up and running by the 1st of July. That's now been changed to the 1st of October. If we go back to the initial policy statement, first home saver accounts could be offered by superannuation funds. Well, that's all changed. Now it's banks, building societies, credit unions, friendly societies, life insurers, and not all super funds. Okay, RSC licensees with a public offer licence can offer first home saver accounts, but only through a separate trust. It's got to be kept separate from their super business. Whereas for the banks, building societies, etc., they can merge it much more effectively into their existing business. Who can open a first home saver account? Well, again, some of those rules have changed, but basically it's those between 18 and 65. You have to provide your TFN before you can open an account. You must not have previously purchased or built a home to live in Australia, but it's fine if you've had investment properties. They've removed the requirement that you must be an Australian resident, and you can't have had a first home saver account previously. So you can only ever have one first home saver account, although there will be special rules to allow portability. You can swap from one first home saver account to another. Contributions, they can either be made by the account holder themselves or some other person, perhaps their parents. But contributions can only be from after-tax income. Salary sacrifice not allowed. On budget night, the government canned some of the contribution requirements, the minimum initial contribution of $1,000. Which should help those with small assets to at least open an account. They've removed the maximum $10,000 per annum requirement and replaced that with a maximum account balance of $75,000. Presumably that was to simplify the rules, maybe removing the maximum $10,000 contribution and replacing it with a $75,000 account balance cap might make it a little bit simpler for those funds that are offering deposit type accounts. It might make it a little bit more difficult for funds that are offering investment linked, because when do you actually hit your $75,000? You might be over it one day, you might be under it the next. How are they going to control that? Government contributions. You'll get a government contribution on contributions you make up to $5,000 per annum. Government contribution in version 3 is 17% of your contribution up to $850 per annum. They've scrapped the previous differential government contributions that provided higher benefits to higher income earners. These government contributions will only be paid if you're an Australian resident. So you can still have an account if you're a non-resident, but you'll only get the contribution if you are an Australian resident. Investment income in these accounts will be taxed at 15%, paid by the fund itself, so operating very similar to superannuation. Banks and building societies will only be able to offer deposit type accounts, whereas RSC licensees and life insurers will be able to offer a wider range of investment options. So investment choice, but we suspect that the government or APRA may place limitations on that choice. The government seems to consider that first-time saver accounts are short-term investments and therefore the assets backing them should be much more consistent with a short-term investment philosophy. So I would expect that it may not be possible to offer, say, 100% share portfolios, but we haven't seen those restrictions yet. Withdrawals from these accounts will be tax-free if you use them to purchase or build a first home, subject to other requirements, including you must have contributed a minimum of $1,000 in each of four financial years, which might actually only be 2 years and 2 days if you make your first contribution on the 30th of June in 1 year, 2 full years of $1,000, and then another contribution on the 1st of July in the 4th year. You could then take your money out tax-free, provided that you actually do live in your home, and there'll be rules around that. I think you've got to live in your home for at least 6 months within 12 months after the you've withdrawn your money or after completion of the purchase. You must also withdraw your full account balance. You can't leave some of it behind. It's all got to go. Now, we've still got some issues here that haven't been explained yet. What happens if I withdraw my money to purchase a home and the purchase falls through? What happens with my money? You can also transfer your money to super at any time. For example, if you want to access money under financial hardship rules, get it out of your first-time saver account, transfer it to super, and then use the financial hardship rules under superannuation. You're also supposed to transfer your first-time saver account to your superannuation fund if you don't use the account to purchase your first home. So if, for example, you buy a home and don't withdraw your funds to pay for that home, you've got to transfer it to super. They also had a rule in version 2 that you had to transfer your first-time saver account to your super fund if you died, and then get the super fund to pay out. That's now been removed. You can actually get your death benefit straight from the first-time saver account. You can transfer your money to super, or you must transfer your money to super when you get to 65. If you reach 60, you can actually take it out in cash without paying tax. But again, once it's transferred to super, you can't open another first-time saver account. So as this is an SEBPC session, just thought I'd concentrate on a couple of issues for the superannuation industry. Firstly, the requirement for RSC licensees to offer these accounts through a separate trust will result in additional costs. Is it going to be possible for an RSC licensee to offer a full investment choice scenario through a separate trust that has got no assets to start with? How does it build up an appropriate asset base? And also, there are some problems for account holders. What happens if they want to purchase their first home before they've met the 4-year requirement? Technically, their money is locked in. They can't access it. Once they've purchased their home using other funds, they will have to transfer their first home saver account to super, where it will be preserved until retirement. If somebody eventually decides that they can't afford to buy a home, they can't access their first home saver account. What happens if they move overseas? What happens if they inherit a home and no longer can use the money in their account to purchase a home? It's all locked in. Will the potential investment options or the limitations on those investment options turn some people away from first home saver accounts? So my second question to you is, do the advantages of the government contribution and the 15% tax on investment income outweigh the disadvantages? One thing we don't know yet is what happens if you lie to your first home saver account provider. If you go along to your provider and say, I'm going to use this money to purchase my first home, please give it to me. So you get your money in hand and then you go and spend it on something else. We know there will be penalties, but what those penalties are, we don't know yet. So perhaps it will be possible for members to lie to their provider and get their money, subject to paying the appropriate penalty. So that's me, Paul.
Thanks very much, John. I'll now introduce Brad Jeffrey. Brad's a director and senior actuary for Watson Wyatt in Australia and also the practice leader for the Australian Superannuation Consulting Practice in Australia. He's got over 28 years' experience in the superannuation and employee benefits industries with both life office and consulting experience. He's heavily involved in the superannuation industry in Australia through speaking at industry events and authoring Watson Wyatt publications on topical superannuation issues. And he's also a member of the Institute of Superannuation Employee Benefits Practice Committee. So welcome, thanks, Brad.
Thanks, Paul. I've just got two brief topics to talk to you about today, two areas where the SEBPC is seeking some clarification. So I just want to make sure people were aware of them, and if people have got other thoughts that they'd like to share with us so that we can put into any submissions, we'd, of course, gratefully take them. I'm assuming people know what no TFN contributions are. This is if you have got a no TFN for a particular member, the contributions in respect of them, or the concessional contributions, form part of the fund's assessable income and therefore will incur tax. That's all explained in section 295.610.1 of the Act. The key expression in the Act, which has given rise to, I guess, some issues, or the issue for defined benefit interests, is that it's defined as a contribution made to a fund to provide superannuation benefits for an individual. So I guess the issue is, in respect of defined benefit interest, are such contributions caught? Because are such contributions in respect of an individual? So there has been, I guess, a variety of opinions that we've come across in our dealings in the industry, and there is some uncertainty. So we have approached the ATU for some guidance. One view quite common in the industry at the moment is that simply DB contributions are not caught by this definition. I must admit I don't have personal experience, but I understand some funds have taken legal advice that supports that view. We did come across, though, a recent indication that the ATO is thinking that they are. And the suggestion that has been made is that we should do some sort of apportioning basis on the actual contributions, perhaps in proportion for an individual, that is, to their NTC-type contribution compared to the total of all members' NTC-type contributions. So some sort of apportionate basis. I guess we've got concerns with that, of course, that it's we think it's a bit late to find that out now because we're getting near the end of the year and our administration teams are screaming no more change. So pretty concerned about, I guess, the practicalities of doing something. Obviously, we're concerned about the contribution basis. I don't think we'd think that some sort of apportionment of actual contributions could be fair or reasonable. So obviously an equity issue there. Issues too about what are we going to do in relation to exits that have occurred throughout the year so far. If we didn't have a TFN for them, how could we recoup that cost? And if the view does come out quite clearly that we have to report something and there are some funds out there with legal advice saying they don't, then we get into a bit of an argument about who's right, which has sort of makes me think back to surcharge issues and DB members. And the last thing I want to do is go back and think about surcharge, to be honest. So we have approached ATO, not Treasury, for a dialogue on this. So that is, I guess, where we are at this day, you know, as of today. Unless something's come through my BlackBerry, still no response to our request for a meeting. So that's one issue, one current topical issue. The other one is in relation to anti-detriment payments. So cast your mind back and note the typo, 1 July 1988, not 2008. Anti-detriment payments. They came in back when taxable contributions were introduced in 1 July 1988. Premise for them was that when those taxable contributions were introduced, which was at the time a bringing forward of benefits tax, statements made that no member effectively is worse off by this, but of course that didn't apply in the case of a death benefit. A death benefit was not an EDP, it was paid to a dependent, there was no tax, so clearly tax reducing that benefit, tax on contributions could reduce that benefit, or could, if that benefit wasn't reduced, require extra contributions to fund it. So that was the premise behind anti-detriment payments. Legislation was quite brief, quite simple. You work out the notional payment reduction due to the contributions tax divided by the complying superfund tax rate. So pretty simple, not necessarily particularly helpful because it's open to quite some interpretation. And that interpretation we all took was from, and I guess the guidance we saw was from the explanatory memorandum that came out back in 1988 or 89 with the legislation. That explanatory memorandum basically said if it's a DB fund, the actuary works it out. If it's not a DB fund, you leave it to the auditor, or you can rely on this formula. So the fact that this formula was in the explanatory memorandum, I suggest sort of became the norm or the default that people were used. The formula, basically what it's saying is that you apportion the accrued benefit, and then you gross it up for tax, and you apply effectively effectively an approximation to the tax rate, so that has been incurred. So that existed for a long time, from the 80s up until really 2006, when ATA guidance was issued in the form of an interpretive decision, number 290, which basically applied just for an accumulation interest and took a very simple formula, which was not dissimilar to the formula I just had up there. Better super comes along, some of the terminology that we're used to goes away, no such thing, for example, as an undeducted contribution anymore, so the formula needed to be updated, which occurred. It could produce a slightly more generous outcome if you had service back before 1983, but we're getting a long way away from 1983 now, so generous is perhaps too strong a word, but it's just obviously a practical change to fit in with the new legislation. Better super, though, I think slightly narrowed the definition of who was eligible because it did speak before about a dependent and dependents, spouse, children, financial dependents is generally in the broad definition of dependent. The legislation in Better Super referred to, I think, just spouse and children. So perhaps financial dependents who might have been covered by the previous definition are not covered by the formula in 2007/219. So, just to be aware of that. I guess it ought to be aware, of course, that it only applies to death benefits paid to dependents, and the new terminal illness benefit is not a death benefit, so getting that potential, I guess, death benefit a little bit early won't generate an anti-detriment payment. So, situation looks quite clear for accumulation interests. What about defined benefit funds? If we're still relying on a formula like the formula on the previous slide, we've got an issue because, again, it is couched in terms that no longer exist. So we have sought, some guidance to see if, well, I guess just some indication as to whether there is any guidance about to come out. We haven't found out the answer to that question yet. So we need to find out, I guess, is there likely to be some guidance, or if not, should we come up with some guidance? Should we come up with a formula that is not dissimilar, I guess, to the way in which those interpretive divisions came out in 2006 and were amended in 2007? Perhaps take that same kind of principle and apply it to the formula that we had on the that was in the original explanatory memorandum. So again, it's a second sort of current issue, watch this space issue, things that we're taking up actively at the moment. And if you have any experiences or things you'd like us to raise as well, perhaps when we turn over to question time in the next 30 seconds, you might like to share it with us then, or please feel free to email me as soon as you can. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Brad. I'll now throw it open to discussion. If you would like to make a comment or ask a question, would you please come forward? Michael?
Can I ask John Water, well, it's probably a really dumb question, but it's one that I'm really interested in. First-home saver accounts, if you actually already have a house, can you still take out a first-home saver account?
If you actually own a house that has always been used for investment purposes, yes, you can. But if you have owned your own house or currently own your own house for living in, no, you can't.
No, you can't. Okay. I wasn't 100%
Nick Khalil, another dumb question on home saver accounts. First of all, can you explain what happens if you meet the tax-free withdrawal requirements? I wasn't clear what happens if you don't satisfy those. Is it the case that you're not able to withdraw them, or that you get a tax penalty, in which case, what is it? That's the number one. The other one is just, by the nature of these things, I'd expect the government would have something to say about the fees that can be charged. Are they doing anything on that front?
Thanks, Nick. The withdrawal bit is a little unclear. In what they have announced up until now, it says you can only withdraw your account if you're going to use that money to purchase or build a home. And then you must live in it. If you withdraw it and don't use it, you will be penalised. What we don't know is what those penalties are. Do you go to jail? Don't know. Do you get some financial penalty that will be perhaps the having to return any government contributions, plus also make up for the savings that you've made in tax on investment income? So people might be able to wear that. They're not much worse off than they would have been if they'd never set one up. Or will the penalties be more significant than that? I mean, we haven't seen legislation yet. We don't know what those penalties are. And sorry, was there a second? The fees, I've heard no indication that the government will be restricting fees. They've certainly indicated that they're looking at product disclosure statements, and they will be aiming at having very short product disclosure statements. But I don't believe there's an intention to restrict fees. That will come down to competitive market forces. Although on fees, it's a little unclear too whether they're going to apply member protection, as in super, perhaps with a higher minimum account balance. So that's another possibility that we haven't seen yet.
Thanks, Rob. I'll go off. I'm coming to you, John, but I'll deal with Brad first. Brad, it's not ominous at all. I've been quite intrigued on the anti-detriment payments, on the interaction between anti-detriment payments and transition to retirement. Where people are saying, yes, you can, when you do the calculations and you can do your transition to retirement and you're arbitraging the tax, but if you die 5 or 10 years later, you use your anti-detriment payment. So there's an interaction between anti-detriment payments and the financial planning cycle where it may cause you, if you think you're in bad health, to leave your money in super and not do pension because you will get the anti-detriment payments. So anti-detriment payments are actually going to become very valuable. And it's how do you communicate, you know, to people beyond 65, which was never ever the case previously. So that the interaction between longevity, anti-detriment payments, financial planning is a really interesting question. So people who are knowledgeable are going to have to start to guess how long they're going to live and the value attached to that. So interesting to see if you guys do some work on that going forward.
Well, I just can answer that. And now we haven't, I guess we've been concentrating today on just clarifying exactly how we calculate the year. But you do raise an interesting issue because I sometimes think people are starting to forget about them because they started in 1988. But they're getting more valuable increasingly all over time. So, and there's issues, I guess, about... I guess there's this confusion about how they're calculated, or you know, I guess memories are starting to fade as to why they came about in the first place. Yeah. But increasingly, some of our clients I know that just have this an automatic thing that they just do it and pay it every time. Yeah. Some you've got to remember to remind them about every time because death occurs, luckily, not too often. But they're increasingly in value, so I guess this is a starting point and we should take it further from
here. I mean, I'm just throwing this up to cause debate. I'm not saying this is what I believe. But where in the legislation does it say it doesn't apply to pensioners?
My understanding is it gets turned off. It's only in the accumulation phase.
But where in the legislation?
Sorry, I don't read legislation. John.
Again, without having the opportunity to go back and look at the legislation, I tend to agree with Matthew. I can't recall seeing anywhere where it gets turned off. I admit it does only apply to lump sum payments. It does not apply to the payment of a reversionary pension. But if your allocated pension or account-based pension, the remaining balance is paid as a lump sum on death, I think it may apply.
Okay, we'll give you some more work for Gus to do. my question to John about first-home saver is looking at... The government moved from $4 billion to $6.5 billion. My question is, will we get anywhere near either $4 billion or $6.5 billion, you know, the process? So as a representative of a big fund, we don't have a propensity to offer them. The logic sort of says, you know, we might be lucky to get $500 million. If we were very good, we might get $1 billion. But we're not going to get that, so we're not going to do it. So superannuation funds, you know, sort of aren't going to participate. So the question is, as a consumer... Is this just another level of middle-class welfare? You know, why would a genuine first home saver go and put $5,000 in? And as a father of children who could be doing it, I'm sort of thinking, wow, I don't have to put money in my child's first home saver account because it just sort of like doesn't make sense. And my question is, do we actually think the mechanics will get to $4.5 to $6 billion, or is this just a sort of a greater? Is this like an RSA that's all going to disappear down the gurgler?
If you want my personal opinion, Ray...
Yes, always value it, John.
I think this is a dead-in-the-water RSA type. good chance of that happening. We had one of our major clients do a focus group with their own employees. And their employees went in quite excited about first home saver accounts. When the rules were explained to them... No thanks. Not interested.
And that's my view as a consumer.
I went to my own kids who are in their early 20s. So prime market for purchasing a first home. I don't want any investment restrictions, thanks, Dad. I don't want to lock my money in for 4 years.
Would Dad put the money in?
I think that's the question. Will first home saver accounts be the opportunity for rich parents to put $5,000 into an account for their kids to give them a kickstart in purchasing their own home?
And will that get to $4 billion?
I can't see it getting to $4 billion anywhere near in the near future. And
I mean, personally, I think the rules have locked super funds out of the game. So we're back to banks, life officers, basically, who are going to be offering deposit-type, fairly unattractive-type products, in my view, with my SEBPC hat on. I'd be interested to know whether any other funds, I mean, you've got one industry fund, Ray, that's not looking at introducing it.
We don't have a propensity to do it at all. We just can't see a market in it. The only would be defence a strategy for existing vendors, and then I suppose they're in Queensland anyway, they don't save money anyway.
Bill, have you got a comment? You're not public office, so there's another another fund out of the agenda.
I'm pleased that we can't do it as the manager, like it. But it's the sort of thing the trustees could say, "Don't do it," and in which case we would, but unfortunately we won't be allowed to. That's not on the record.
And if it is a dead duck, well, maybe we'll all be pleased later on.
Thanks, Brett. All right, well, thanks everyone for your participation, and if you could join with me in thanking the three speakers for a useful session.